and welcome to another episode of the Audaciousness Podcast with me, Helen Strong.
And me, Maribel Ortega. In this podcast, we showcase individuals who have set themselves bold and audacious goals and have worked to achieve them, with the aim of inspiring others to also set themselves audacious goals and to create a positive movement in the world.
We'd like to highlight the fact that even regular people like you and me can have audacious goals, and that role models are in fact all around us. Each and every one of us can have an impact in some way.
Thank you for joining us. We're delighted to have you with us. So Helen, tell us about the guest we're going to hear from today.
Yeah, we're going to hear from Colin O'Donohoe, who is a musician and a composer, and he's based in Phoenix, Arizona, but with Irish roots, which he mentions a few times in this interview. And I'm going to read the bio that we've put up about Colin in our show notes, because basically this says it all. So this is what we've written here. Colin O'Donohoe is a musician and composer who founded the Pangean Orchestra, an ensemble of performers and instruments gathered from all over the world. He has performed in venues from Mongolia to Brazil and from Iceland to Turkey. Recognized as an outstanding composer, leader, performer, and arts advocate through awards, commissions, and grants, Colin's global impact has earned him the title of World Maestro. So it's a pretty impressive bio there.
Indeed.
His website is called worldmaestro.com, and the link to that is also in the show notes. And I met Colin earlier this year in an online workshop we were both taking part in. It was a podcasting workshop, as it happens. And when Colin learned about the topic of our podcast, he volunteered to be interviewed because he said that what he does is pretty audacious. And I have to agree with him, as we'll find out in this conversation.
Exactly. So let's listen to the interview with Colin now, and we'll come back in around half an hour to talk about what we've learned. We hope you enjoy the interview.
Colin, hello, and thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us for our podcast, Audaciousness. Now, we met earlier this year on an online workshop that we were both taking part in, and you contacted me. You sent me a direct message from one participant to another, and I'm going to read out the message that you sent me. This is what you wrote. You wrote, "I'm a legally blind composer who formed a global orchestra 10 years ago and still lead it. That's audacious, right?" And I thought, it is indeed audacious. Let's get him on the podcast. And so I'd like to start, Colin, by unpacking this statement that you wrote to me earlier this year. I mean, I imagine forming a global orchestra would be a challenging thing for anyone who isn't legally blind. So I'm curious as to what challenges you in particular faced. So my first question is actually a three-in-one question. What do you do? Why do you do it? And what challenges have you faced?
Okay, what do I do? That's fun. There's a bunch. So I create the music, I compose music, and that's kind of the step one, is to have some music to do. The other thing is recruiting and socializing and building a network of musicians. And the way that happens is I'm already a professional musician, and I've trained since I was 12 at Eastman School of Music up in Rochester, New York. So I was trained in theory and jazz performance. The reason that's important is you fast forward 8 years, 9 years, I'm in my 20s, and I gained a lot of respect for my abilities. Now, that among my peers, when you can play, it gives you a certain level where people will listen to you a bit more. So it's easier to get the musicians on your side when you yourself know what you're talking about. You yourself tell them, I want to form this group, I know I need this, I know I need that. And then you kind of have people join your team. You also do a lot of listening. When I was putting the groups together, I would go out to where they perform. And where they're comfortable, I would listen to their show. And then I would have a bunch of follow-up questions. And why do you do this? And how do you do this? I would go to people's homes. We have tea, we have whatever, and we just kind of hang out. And we build that rapport. And over time, that allows me to invite them into a project that I want to lead. So that takes a little bit of, you know, a couple years really of just building that rapport. Why do I do it? That's a good question. The seed started in about 2003, I believe, when the United States invaded Iraq. And in the United States, we were inundated on television of these video game style videos of a little dark screen, a green little arrow in the middle, and you'd see these explosions, these bombs going off. And I was in a postal store having to return something, and I heard a man behind me saying on his cell phone, "Hey man, why don't you come on over later and we'll have a few beers and we'll watch the bombs drop." And for me, it was quite disgusting that how could we as a people become so far apart that watching their death and mutilation could be a form of entertainment, like a football game, and your buddies come over and cheer it on and swig some beers. It was disappointing to me. But I felt like, okay, there are these two groups that are so far apart. We're very cool with killing them and we're very desensitized. You can't change that overnight. You can't somehow go to those people, yell at them, "Hey, you're being mean," and all of a sudden they're going to say, "Yeah," and everything's going to be happy and we're going to hold hands and have flowers and whatever. That doesn't happen. It has to happen over a period of time. And the only way that I felt with the pulpit I had of being a leader and a musician was to try to bring people from all these different backgrounds together. I'm not saying we're going to solve racism or we're going to solve world political disagreements, but it's a start and it's a symbol that, okay, this is starting to be possible. We come together, we play each other's music. And what I learned from my father, who is a disabled veteran from Vietnam, he said the first step in his training was to dehumanize your opponent. You don't think about them as human. You come up with some slang terms, like whatever, I don't need to repeat them. But that's the first step. So if I can combat the first step, if it's harder to call someone a this or a that because they're on stage with you or they're at the show that you paid a ticket to go see, it's a little harder to believe they're inhuman, right? Mm. So that's the why. And then as this project has been evolving, I realized from my own artistic spirit that I wanted to break out and create this new ensemble movement that could be repeated all over the world. It doesn't just have to be the Pangean Orchestra, but maybe we're inventing a new system of orchestra that's not boring, that's not got the connotation of, oh, that's where you put your nice cocktail dress and your suit and you go sip a little wine and you feel rich and sophisticated and you go into the theater, which is what it's become. Orchestral music 200 years ago was cutting edge. It was the newest sounds, and for most people, the only chance in their life or their year to hear music. You didn't have it in your home. You didn't have it on your phone. You don't get to walk and listen to music. The only time you could hear music was at the theater, at the play. So it was extremely exciting. Now it's one of the most, you know, for most people, boring entertainments. They put it on to sleep, to calm down their child, the Mozart effect. Let's play Mozart so it'll magically make our kids smarter. But there's no excitement for most people. I have an excitement, but how do I make that more universal? So I feel like the orchestra has to reflect the people the same way it did in 1800 or when Mozart was alive in the late 1700s. We have to make a music that excites people. Mm-hmm. So that became the second impetus, the second why, as far as why I do this project.
Yeah. And I guess that's also leading into the challenges that I asked you about that, because that seems to be a big challenge to get the audience again then.
The challenge is twofold. The challenge one is on an audience, which I really drastically underestimated. And then the other challenge that I underestimated was musicians themselves all trying to take a, we need to do it this way. No, we need to do it that way. We need to do whatever. That became a challenge. Or one musician saying, I'll only play if you fire that guy. Things like that. I wasn't expecting those issues. So the audience, yeah, it's an issue, but that's an issue if I formed a rock band. That's a issue if I formed a pop project. It doesn't matter. There's always the challenge of garnering that kind of core group and then getting that core group to go and tell their friends. That's a problem. My other challenges have been things like my own vision, which drastically slow me down. And then the fact that I have traveled so much, especially I was divorced in 2015. I was living in Manhattan. That happened. And then after that, I was kind of a vagabond or something. I chose that time to explore the world. So I was in Ireland for several months. I was in Amsterdam. I was in Turkey, Brazil, Mongolia, Japan. And all this time, I decided to just study and learn. Learn from the people, humble myself, take a back seat and just listen. But because I've traveled so much, people don't even know where I am. So then they don't know whether to trust me. And because I've traveled, if I set up shop in Phoenix, Arizona, how long am I going to be here? So it hurts the trust a little, which is why I want to get that board or some core group here in Phoenix. So if I do go, and chances are I probably will travel again because I love it. There's a core group there. There can be someone that takes in my plays, that leads the group and puts on a show. The project should be bigger than me. It should be bigger than a one person. I just haven't been able to do that yet.
Mm. I like that you're saying the project should be bigger than me, should be bigger than a one person. And you said just a couple of minutes ago that your own vision slowed you down. What did you mean by that?
Daily. From the obvious, like being a conductor, where you normally have all the staffs, all the music in front of you, and you can quickly tell the violinist, no, you have this here. Or the percussion, I need more of this on which measure, because you can see it all. What I have to do is I have to memorize the whole score so that I know what I need and I can tell the person where it is because I memorized it.
Wow.
So memorizing, I've always been very fast at memorizing, but it still takes a lot of listening through the songs. Even if I've written the song, it might sound weird, but even if I composed it, that doesn't mean I remember every single note I wrote. I have to listen over and over. And because I know me, I know what I tend to do. So sometimes I just guess. I'm pretty sure I asked you to do that, right? And they'll check that. That's on me, you know, the musician. Also in correspondence, everything I do, I have to zoom in on stuff. Text messaging, people like to text. I have to zoom in to respond. It's a little frustrating. The various apps and things I'm just not good at seeing. So slows me down. The only things I have in my corner which don't hurt is I've been working with the same software for 20 years and I kind of already know where things are. Again, it's more memorization. It's more, I know where it should be and I just go to that. People don't appreciate it until they're sitting with me and they see how I work. Mm-hmm. They see how much I have to zoom in. They see when I'm composing the music on the notation software that I can really only see one line at a time instead of 20 at the same time. So those are the frustrations. Also, I can't drive. So when I want to go meet musicians, I have to find a ride. Uber and Lyft and things, they've made it a lot easier. When I was living in New York City, it was a much easier because I learned the subway system pretty well. So that wasn't as much of a trouble. But when you're in, like I was in Gort for a while in Ireland, that's tricky. There's only one bus that takes you to Galway. And, you know, it's a little bit tougher. Istanbul was a lot easier. I do speak a few languages that does help me get around in these cities, but still, you know, it's a little tough. And seeing things, seeing the signs, seeing stuff, I can't. So I'm a little behind where someone that with a healthy vision wouldn't have the same problem.
And still, Colin, you are doing so many things. You've mentioned that I was wondering also about this vision, that question that Helen already mentioned, and all these challenges that you have mentioned. What brings you then, because you are doing it, what brings you the most fulfillment?
That's a great question. Thank you for that.
Okay.
Oh, you're making Happy me to think in the morning. That's my biggest challenge is trying to think without sufficient coffee in my bloodstream. Repeat the question.
What gives you the most fulfillment in spite of all the challenges?
I think the biggest fulfillment is that I haven't given up. And I've wavered for sure, but when I wake up in the morning, I still have this like unbelievable passion and a bit of a self-belief that I can do it. So fulfilling is, I guess for myself and my internal, is that I know I've done that. I can be proud or happy with, you know, my life if it was to end today, which I hope it doesn't, that I did what I wanted. I tried. I may not have ended up sharing the stage with Beyonce or something, but I did it. I worked on it. I didn't let all the noise from outside stop me from trying to do this. But sadly, I would be very fulfilled if audiences everywhere just loved it and I had a million people on my, you know, email list and blah, blah, blah. That would be great. That would be fulfilling, but that's external fulfillment. And I feel like you need to have an internal fulfillment. And for me, when I, you know, when I'm by myself, when I'm whatever, I'm excited about what I do. I know I can do this till I'm 100. I don't want to retire. I think when I'm 80, I'll hopefully still have the same excitement. And that helps you when you get slammed down on the ground by those external sources that we're always looking for an external acknowledgement of, hey, that was good. Mm-hmm. But that rarely really comes and it's always fleeting. The same people that congratulate you today are going to be your biggest critic tomorrow or 6 hours later. It's not really reliable. You have to have your own internal fulfillment, I believe.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's lovely that you say, you know, you're doing this for yourself, you know, and that you could do it until you're 80 or 100. You know, you've obviously found your calling. And it sounds like you found it at a young age as well. Did you do anything before you became a musician? Or did you always know that this is what you wanted to do?
I think I always knew since I was five, and my father always listened to a ton of music every day. He, like I said, he was a veteran, and because of being a veteran, his hearing was very messed up. So he would blast this music. And I don't know, I just grew up with it. And when I was a kid, I remember he put on the Thriller album with Michael Jackson. And at the time, I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And then MTV came out, and that was cool. And I wanted to be a drummer. Age 12, I formed a rock band with a friend. And I just, nothing has made me feel as alive as when I'm either composing or performing music. I think I was 14 or 15. I heard this album, Enigma, by, Enigma's the band. I thought that was an orchestra in France. I didn't know it was electronic music. I didn't know that existed. So I thought it was this cutting edge orchestra in France. The reason I thought it was French is this girl speaks some French in the opening song or two. So I thought, oh, France must be way ahead of America. And then I learned a little later, oh, that's not a real orchestra. So then I decided, well, I can make one that does similar things. So probably by 16, I was forming my own orchestras in high school and putting on things. I had probably more self-confidence than I should, but all teenagers do, right? I have some, so.
No, that sounds fantastic. I mean, you said, you know, the musical background came from your father, and you know, you grew up with the musical background, but being a musician is one thing. Taking the lead and saying, I'm going to make my own orchestra and then get people together. And what you're doing now, getting people from all over the world together to do it. This is a different set of skills, isn't it? How did you go into this part of your career, so to speak, going from being a musician and composer to actually getting people together and making an orchestra?
I think the biggest change, the biggest assistance, I went to graduate school in Carnegie Mellon for arts management, not for composition and not for performance. And I knew at the time what I wanted to do, and I knew what skills I didn't have. So I knew I needed to go there, learn the admin side, learn how people run a group. And while I was in grad school, my first semester, I formed a Chinese orchestra, American Chinese Orchestra. And I didn't mean or intend to be the leader. I just wanted to be the drummer. I had been working in a Chinese orchestra in Phoenix, and I was really fascinated by the history of China and the instruments of China. And so when I came to Pittsburgh, and I knew there's a professor, Belle Young, at the University of Pittsburgh, who is a leading person in ethnomusicology for Chinese music. He works in Hong Kong as well. So I thought he could be a mentor or a resource. And while he was a bit preoccupied, he did provide all the instruments, all the love and support and the attaboy kind of thing. And he helped. And over the next 2 years, even as a white guy running a Chinese group, it became quite successful. I gained some respect, and that really helped my confidence. And then after that Chinese experience, after doing that, because I'm kind of a perpetual student of music, I wanted to branch out. I wanted to learn more about Arabic music, Turkish music. I had been raised on Irish music since I was born. I always heard on Sundays, it was always Irish music day. There was a lot of Scottish music too, but mainly the Irish, and a lot of political things, not very flattering to the British, which is a bias I had to get over, because my family had suffered through the Black and Tans and the oppression of 1916 and things like that. So we always had a healthy dose of rebel spirit in the music.
So it sounds like on your journey to become where you are now, you always realized or recognized what was missing, and then you know, you sought a mentor, or you did a period of study, or you discovered Turkish music and different music. So you're always on this perpetual, you said you're a perpetual student, always learning. Is this something that you think is, well, is necessary for, I was going to say any musician, but any job, I guess, any person in life needs to be perpetually learning. Would you agree?
I would. And I think there's an important thing for audience members, anyone that's striving to be audacious and do that, is that that's great. Keep it and do it. But the number one thing you can do is listen. You really need to listen to who are your constituents, who are the people you want to work with. And as much as I'm a talker, kiss the Blarney Stone, raised by the Irish storytellers, I never shut up, but I have to learn how to shut up and just listen. Take a back seat, humble yourself, have the self-confidence that you already know you're good, but you don't have to show it every day, every minute. And I think that's something I've seen with younger up-and-comers, is they're a bit insecure, and so they overcome or overcompensate their insecurity by just playing all the time and trying to show off and trying to show, hey, I'm good. I'm a bit understated, as hard as that might be to believe with my constant talking, is that I'm able to take a step back or five steps back and let other people shine, let other people do it. And it's a sign of respect, learning even some of their language, learning the basic conversational things, the numbers, things. I say numbers because I've been in a lot of foreign countries. I had no idea how important numbers was until you go shopping. The first time you go, you need to know how much something costs. What is this? It comes up every day. But to show a little respect, to do the research, to read your backgrounds before an interview, not to make the focus on yourself, but make the focus on the group. So the group feels good. So they have a positive experience and then they want to learn more about you, but only because you first shut up and let them tell you about them.
That sounds like excellent advice, Colin. Is there any other advice that you would give to anybody wanting to do this line of work, either musician or starting an orchestra? What other advice would you give?
I would say don't rely or listen so much to family members or your best friends. They're not your target audience. They're not. Families are so different, right? I have identical twin daughters. They are very different personalities. And if there's any proof that we're all different, take identical twins and see the huge difference in their personalities. So your family, while they love you, and probably because they do love you, they give horrible advice. And these great ideas that your listeners have, because I'm sure everyone tuning in is a, you know, they got a budding audacity somewhere. Those ideas are stillborn and they need resuscitation right away. And if you have a great idea and it is stillborn and people just say, look at that, see, it has no legs, it has no traction, then you're going to believe them more than half the time. You're going to, maybe it's a book you want to write, a series of blogs, things that are passionate for you, that you want to get this thing out there, whether it's music, whether it's engineering, whether it's a new system of whatever. And then your friends are like, oh, that'll never work. That's stupid. They're not saying it to be mean. They're just, they're not your target audience. Don't put a lot of value on the negative things you're brother, your kid, your mom, your neighbor, your best buddy since you were five. Don't put so much importance on that.
And those are external critics. What are your thoughts on the inner critic and how do you deal with that negative thinking? For example, oh, I won't be able to achieve that, or I'm not confident today, etc.
I think there's a few ways to combat that. I've never seen it articulated and put better than Stephen Pressfield's book on the War of Art. That's a book every single audacious person needs to read. So he just says, look, yes, you're going to have these demons. He calls it resistance. And that's a big, you know, kind of a dragon. And the only way to fight the resistance is to do. Now, getting yourself to the keyboard to compose, turning the program on, dealing with the technical issues, you know, that's all stuff that wants to kill your creativity. So you need to just sit down. What I did for several years when I was writing for television is there was a commercial when I was a kid about Dunkin' Donuts. And there was this man that always woke up at 4 or 5 and he said, time to make the donuts. And he went outside to go make donuts. I did the same thing. I wake up at 6 and I say, time to make the donuts. And I go in my room and I compose. Sometimes I compose amazing stuff and sometimes I compose crap. Doesn't matter. I compose something. So that's one of the things. The inner critic is always going to be there. And it's generally, in my brain, it's been personified in some professors I've had or some peers I've had that I know, oh, if they listen to this, they're going to know I chose this chord and not that chord. Oh, they're going to know I should have had a better French horn line and I didn't. And those things are so dumb to let it kill you, because the audience, the energy is what's more important. The overall nature of the song is more important than what ingredient you put in or you forgot or you don't know as well. So that part of the critic is strong. The part of the critic, yeah, I'm audacious and yeah, I believe in myself and yeah, I do this. But at the same time, I don't. At the same time, I battle depression. I battle anxiety. And these things are things that kill me sometimes. I've been deeply depressed sometimes, and then that's really hard to overcome. And I sometimes don't even know how I did. So those are the inner critics, which are far more damaging than the external. But a lot of times the external plant the seeds in your brain for the self-doubt to grow. And the more energy you give to those negative thoughts, the more they grow within you. And you need to, instead of fighting those weeds and trying to pull them out of your brain, it's better to actually plant seeds of positivity and water those. So yeah, the negative are always going to be there, but hopefully your positive ones over time grow taller, take more of the sunlight, and the bad ones start to diminish. But I can't say I've figured out that formula yet. And I don't know if I always will. Some things that give me solace is Beethoven wasn't always happy with what he wrote. Frank Lloyd Wright, his advice was, with your first few buildings, plant a lot of ivy so people won't see the mistakes in your architecture. Another thing is, great music is never finished, it's only abandoned, and then you move on to your next thing. So for me, reading about other people, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Leonard Bernstein, people that also had self-doubt, and you could think, how? They're so amazing.
Yeah.
I know Lady Gaga is very famous. She's had self-doubt. She's had depression. If someone that on top of the world can face these things, then what makes me think I won't have it? What makes me think I'm different? We're human. We have some things in common. All of us, no matter where we live on the planet, we're human. We're gonna doubt ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're lying if we say we don't.
Yeah. And this leads us there, Colin, very nicely to our final question as we're coming to the end of this interview now. It's been such an interesting conversation that we've had with you. We've got one more question to ask you, and that's to do with the name of our podcast, which is, as you know, Audaciousness.
Yes.
And the audacious part refers to having the audacity to do what you do in the first place. And the ness actually means a piece of land, a spit of land, which juts out into the sea and stays strong no matter what the weather, you know, is throwing at it. So our question, our final question to you is, how do you keep going despite what life is throwing at you? What gives you the solid grounding to continue with what you do?
It is a hard question. I would certainly, at least for the last project, I had my wife and a great producer who had that positive energy and had that support, moral support, emotional support, and also technical support with the producer, that they believed in it. And more than that, they believed in me, that I could get this done. So I think when the last minute star musician cancels on you and there's a technical problem and you don't get the audio quality you wanted or things, that there's enough belief from some inner, very tight-knit people in your life that they catch you. You're always going to stumble. We are not that solid ground. We are human. We stand on 2 feet. Sometimes we get knocked down, and sometimes you got to pick yourself back up. I remember my grandmother from Limerick. She said, if life kicks you down 6 times, then you got to get up 7. That stayed with me. Yeah, the life's going to kick you on the ground. Don't stay on the ground, get back up. And I guess I have those ghosts in my mind that tell me to do it. But the strength to carry on, that's a tough one. I would say I've been very blessed with some people that really do look out for me and pick me up. And sometimes they don't care whether or not I keep pushing on a project. They just want to make sure I don't die. You know, they want to make sure I survive that storm. Mm-hmm. And then they can talk about moving forward. Sometimes you have to nourish yourself. You have to remember that you're human. You have to remember to rest. You have to remember to nourish yourself. And that's why with my project with Pangean, I also do my own personal solo projects. I compose my own music for myself. I do a lot of performing on Native American flutes and drums that feed my soul. Play tin whistle with a pub, and that feeds my soul. I'm not doing it to be a star. I'm not doing it for attention. I'm doing it purely for selfish reasons, to make myself feel good. But that nest part, that ground, you know, I admire it, because it never complains either. It never says, poor me. Whereas humans, we do say, oh, poor me. Oh, if this didn't happen, if only I had more money, then I could do, you know, and those are just negative thoughts. I think sometimes having a great therapist or something can help you to scatter and resort your thoughts. I'm a big believer in acupuncture. I think that helps, but you got to maintain your own body too.
Very good advice, Colin. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of it. Maribel, any last thoughts before we stop?
I just want to thank Colin for taking the time to have this conversation with us. It was extremely inspiring.
Thank you.
Love my blazer, right?
I do love your
the most odd. Audacious blazer I have.
Looking very sharp.
It's pink. Colin's wearing a pink blazer and a pink tie.
Yeah, you got to. Yeah. It helps me feel more audacious.
Thank you so much, Colin, and we wish you all the best of luck with
same
your ventures in the future.
Thank you. Whoa! was a thought-provoking discussion. Listening to that again, Helen, what are some of the key things you're taking away from it?
Oh, there was a lot that I'm taking away from it now, but probably the thing that I'll begin with is when he was describing the challenges and the problems that he faces due to his own impaired vision, like having to memorize the music score, even if he wrote it himself, because he couldn't read it while he's leading the orchestra, but also in day-to-day tasks such as corresponding by text or using a computer software or whatever. I just can't imagine what it must be like not to be able to see the words on a page or on a screen clearly. So full kudos to Colin for persevering with this audacious goal despite these huge challenges he's had to overcome. What did you think about that?
I thought his perseverance is impressive. I like the story that, or not the story, he mentions that his grandmother said to him that if you fall six times, then you get up a seventh time. And that is the attitude to become an audacious person, because things don't necessarily work out the first time. And if you give up right away, then you're never going to get anywhere, don't you?
Indeed. I love that quote. Yeah, don't stay on the ground, get back up. I love that quote from his grandmother. And something else that I want to highlight, he mentioned at the beginning that it was important that he got the knowledge and the expertise which he studied at school and college, because that earned him respect among his peers. And also it was easier to get musicians and other people on his side when it was clear that he knew what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a very important point for anyone doing audacious work. You need the conviction to know that what you're doing is the right thing. And you need to have worked hard at learning your stuff and doing your stuff. And I would even argue living and breathing your stuff. Then not only is it that other people take you more seriously, but it feeds back to yourself and gives yourself this conviction, this reassurance that you are the right person for this task, whatever it might be.
Yes. That makes sense. And I would like to connect that with a similar topic that he discussed, and that is self-confidence. That he mentioned that it's necessary to have self-confidence in order to take a step back and not be talking all the time, to be humble and to just listen. In his case, it's literally listen to music, but I think that we can use it to conversations and to life just in general, because there are these apparently overconfident people that actually are lacking self-confidence and are just overcompensating by talking too much, by praising themselves. And I'm convinced that it is in this power that you feel within yourself, and I think that is that confidence that you feel, okay, I know what I know and I know what I don't know, you know, that knowing this is all I know and I'm okay with this. There's lots I don't know. I'm fine with that. Yeah. And I can sit back and listen and learn.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you're always perfect the way you are right now, because you're exactly where you're meant to be right now. And you know, this listening to others, but listening to, more importantly, to yourself. And Colin mentioned that he's a perpetual student.
Yeah.
So he always knows, he listens to himself and he knows what he doesn't know. And therefore he goes out and gets that knowledge or gets that experience if he needs to. And I think that's a really important thing to be able to recognize. Yeah. I love that expression, perpetual student, that you're always learning.
Yes, well, I'm sure this is something that resonates for both you and me, Helen. You know, like, what's the next course you're going to take? What's the next conference you're going to go? This is somehow how we met. And that's something that I totally believe in, that we are continuous learners of life. At least for me, learning is enriching mm-hmm. and fulfilling.
And there's a famous quote, isn't there? The moment you stop learning is the moment you start dying.
Yeah.
Which I love that quote.
I think that's exactly what happens when you, like, you know, officially retire, which is actually something that Colin mentioned. He's not going to retire. He hopes to be composing when he's 80. And I totally, it's something that I would like to live by, to, like, not really retire. And it's precisely, and that's what I have seen, that when people come to this point where they stop working, stop using their brain in a way that forces them to have challenges, that some type of neural deterioration starts setting in. And actually our brains, especially our neurons, are able to reproduce and to learn. Our brain is able to learn new things till the moment we die. Mm-hmm. And it's just lack of use that we think the older we get, oh no, now I'm older, I can't learn this, I can't learn that. But it's just lack of practice, really.
Yeah. I'd like to go back to something you said earlier, Maribel, about listening, the importance of listening, which Colin talked about. And there was one thing that he said that you shouldn't listen to. And he said, don't listen to your family. They give horrible advice. I thought that was a really interesting part where he said, you know, your friends or your family or whoever are not your target audience, and don't listen to them. And what I thought, both when we had this conversation with Colin and then when I was listening to the interview again, is that we've actually had quite different opinions on this in the 16 or so interviews that we've done so far. So, you know, some people have said, do listen to your friends and family, and others have said, don't. So I think it's going to be quite interesting, Maribel, what comes out when we start to analyze our findings. And this is for the benefit of the listeners. You might have noticed that some of our more recent podcast episodes have been transcribed, at least the interviews within those episodes have been transcribed. Mm-hmm. And the reason for this is that next year we're going to analyze how people have responded to the various questions that we've asked. And this particular one about how did your friends and family react and how did you deal with mm-hmm. that is going to be an interesting one. And we want to see whether there are patterns emerging in some of the responses and the advice given. And we're planning to publish these findings in a book in the second half of next year.
Is that another audacious goal, Helen?
It certainly is. Never stop learning.
Exactly. So we've decided to become authors. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. And so just to finish, I want to pick up on what he said at the very beginning, the story that he told about what prompted him to set up the Global Orchestra, the guy in the postal store who said, let's drink some beers and watch the bombs drop. I found that really quite shocking.
Oh, yeah.
But I do believe that everything happens for a reason. And Colin probably needed to overhear that conversation right at that time in order for something to shift in him. And someone else may have overheard that conversation and done nothing. But for Colin, there was clearly a shift in perspectives which caused him to take action. And I'm wondering whether that is something which might come up in the analysis of the interviews that we do as well, whether there was any particular moment, because this is something, a question that we've asked before, isn't it? What caused you? What motivated you? What shifted in you?
To make a particular decision. Yes, I remember asking, especially those people that decided, like, to change their work and move somewhere else. There's always, like, this moment. And I think we might be coming to the conclusion that there's things happen because they have to happen, you know, like no surprises.
Mm-hmm. Beyond our control, do you mean?
Yes, he was in the case of Colin, I believe that he was able to listen to that message. And that struck a chord in him. Oh, that's even musical.
Pardon the pun.
like you said, somebody else might not have been ready. He was just ripe. He was ready to receive that message and to act upon it. And that's how I interpret that situation.
Sounds good. Thanks very much for listening to this episode of our podcast, Audaciousness. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. A huge thanks to Colin for sharing his fascinating musical story with us.
If you enjoyed this episode, please give it a like. And if you think someone else would benefit from listening to this conversation, please pass it on to them and share it with your friends and family and colleagues. If you know of any other audacious person, including yourself, please get in touch as we'd love to speak with them.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with another audacious person and another audacious episode. See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.